Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box. Affordable, mind-enriching programs.
Gildan Audio presents Do It, Mean It, Be It. The keys to achieve success, happiness, and everything you deserve, at work and in life. By Corey Shanahan. Narrated by Marguerite Gavin. For my darling boy Sam, with all my love. Introduction. Why I wrote this book. I wrote this book because I was frustrated by the number of people who are unhappy with their lives. Too many friends and colleagues complained about hating their jobs, feeling overwhelmed, and not doing the things they really enjoyed. They reported being anxious about their careers, money, relationships, and their lives in general. External events, such as the aftermath of the global financial crisis, the rise of extremism, mass shootings, terror attacks, and Brexit didn't help. The doom and fear-mongering seemed to increase with each new attack and piece of bad economic news. It felt like uncertainty and anxiety had become permanent states. But I don't buy that. I believe that life is rich and good, and it should be lived fully. A couple of years ago, I left the relative safety of corporate life to fulfill my dream of having my own business. I love being an entrepreneur. Sure, it is hard work, but it is also extremely satisfying and fun. Every day I help senior executives reach their goals in business and in life. A bout of cancer and accompanying brush with death this year helped confirm the choices I had made. I was reminded why I like my life so much. Those events made me think more about why people don't live the lives they want and how I could help them. If I can gather some of the wisdom I've gained working with my clients, why not share it and make it available to others? What this book can do for you. This book will help you clarify what is really important to you. It will help you identify the things you want to change. And it will give you all the practical tools to get there. I cover everything from home and work, in between, and beyond. You'll learn to be much more proactive in creating your ideal life. You will learn how to build a system to support your goals. You will also learn how to enjoy and maintain your new state. Whether you want to jumpstart your career, grow a new business, or figure out how to work less and spend more time with the people you love, you'll find the tools to do that in this book. The best ways to use this book. Quickly read the book all the way through. Then go back and start doing the exercises in the areas you care about most. That might include setting goals, getting support infrastructure, or building your brand at work. This book includes real-life examples from around the world from senior figures in business, politics, and the arts that can help and inspire you. You'll hear from people who have shared what worked for them, how they got where they are today, and built the life they wanted. It is chock-full of practical exercises and checklists that will help you focus and jumpstart the ability to find happiness in your life, at work, and in the world. Do it, mean it, be it. No more procrastinating or complaining. This is all you need to get started on the road to a happier, more successful, and more enjoyable life. Chapter 1. You already won the lottery. In a nutshell, first of all, congratulate yourself. You're doing something right. You must be doing something right to even be reading this book. You have been successful in your career and are ambitious to do even better. Sure, things are not perfect. Maybe you are even going through a particularly challenging phase in your professional or private life right now. But if you are reading this, you are probably better off than the 4 billion people on the planet living on less than $2 per day. Sometimes it helps to count our blessings. Count your blessings. Counting your blessings helps to put things in perspective. What am I grateful for? What went well today? A number of years ago, I had dinner for the first time at the home of a new friend. She was a senior official in the Obama administration, and her husband was an expert in environmental issues for a large bank. They were a blended family with two teenage boys and a couple of dogs. Busy lives, busy careers. What struck me that first evening at family dinner was their habit of asking everyone at the table what they were thankful for. It wasn't a special occasion, just a regular weeknight. It was simply what they did whenever they had dinner together. We went around the table and each said what they were thankful for. I felt slightly awkward, but no one else did. Each person took his or her turn. I said I was thankful to be there and to be a part of their family for the evening. I've since made that a habit in my own home, both when we gather with friends, and each weekday night my son and I sit down to eat dinner together. It's a powerful but simple way to reflect on how fortunate we are. Martin Seligman, at the University of Pennsylvania, is considered the father of positive psychology, the philosophy that we should build on our strengths rather than fret about fixing our weaknesses. In his book, Flourish, he recommends a somewhat similar exercise called What Went Well and Why. Here is how it works. At your dinner table, ask people what went well in their day or week and follow up by asking why. This helps your friends or family members to fully recall the good things they experienced and what led to them. You can also do this as a journal exercise at night before going to sleep. I can't vouch for the neuroscience behind it, but I can tell you from experience that recalling positive events and describing them to others is a very effective way of improving your mood and well-being. Another simple way to count your blessings is to look around you. You don't have to go to the poorest countries in the world to see that you are better off than most people on the planet. In your own city or community, there are many people who lack the things you take for granted or who have been devastated by loss. Even when you face serious challenges with your health, finances, or relationships, chances are you're still better off than many. You likely have access to resources and the support of others to help you deal with difficult circumstances as you go through a challenging time. Right now, jot down a list of all the things you have to be thankful for. Don't forget to start with the basics of food, shelter, and companionship. Keep adding. You'll find it's a long list. You may want to get a journal to use with this book, as there will be lots of exercises like this with notes you'll want to return to. What got you here? We are often so focused on what's missing or could be better in our lives that we forget to take stock of what's working. We skip over what we do well and beat ourselves up about what we do poorly. It's time for a little inventory. Instead of waiting for your annual performance appraisal, do one on yourself right now. What are your greatest strengths? What do you do really well? What do most people appreciate about you? Exercise. Create two columns and jot down your greatest strengths and your greatest achievements. Make sure to include both personal and professional attributes and accomplishments. These are the things that got you where you are today. In the achievements column, did you include relationships, friendships, and children? Were you the first person in your family to go to college or to start their own business? Maybe you were the first to get a PhD or be worth $1 million. Do you earn more than your parents ever did? When we focus on our strengths, we are reminded of what we can do and how far we have come. Sometimes it's very far. Gary Cohn is the director of the United States Economic Council and the former chief operating officer of Goldman Sachs. He cut a familiar figure on Wall Street, a burly guy with a bald head and a ready smile. He was a member of the board of directors of the Institute of International Finance when I was a member of the Institute's management team. He always brought a great energy to boardroom meetings and our events. Gary is very sharp and has been enormously successful. He's also been very open about being dyslexic. In his bestseller, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, Malcolm Gladwell recounts Gary's experiences as a child. It took several painful years of teachers thinking he was stupid before he was diagnosed. Gary now credits his dyslexia with his success. He says he got better at taking risks and looking for the upside in opportunities as they arose. Ironically, our deficits can sometimes be what makes us most successful. Whatever traits you listed as strengths have helped get you to where you are now. Those are the same traits that you will tap in to propel yourself forward and create a more satisfying life. It's also important to take stock of what you really enjoy about your life currently. What's working well? What do you really love to do? What are the best moments in your week? For many years, I believed I was trapped in Washington, D.C. My husband and I divorced when my son Sam was very young. Technically, I was free to leave the city, but I wouldn't be able to take Sam with me. His dad was remarried and happily settled in Maryland. He had made it clear he would oppose any move by me to take Sam out of the area. More importantly, they had a good relationship and saw each other frequently. As Sam got older and his departure to college became more imminent, my options for moving became more of a reality. But then it dawned on me that I had actually built a great life in D.C. and was part of a wonderful community of friends and a network of professional relationships. I was too busy looking at grass I thought was greener to realize that I was actually knee-deep in clover. Exercise. Take stock now of all the good things in your life and the routines and pleasures you currently enjoy. This list might include your home, neighborhood, favorite exercise class, the route of your favorite run, a regular sports night, a book club, your Saturday routine with friends or children, your summer vacation, and so on. Played to extreme. Your strengths are what got you here, but they can also be what hold you back. When our strengths are overused or misapplied, they can harm us. This is what I call played to extreme. It's why no one should ever fumble the classic interview question, "What's your greatest weakness?" Don't cite working too hard. That's so obviously self-serving. Instead, take your greatest strength and flip it around. For example, if one of your strengths is attention to detail, then a weakness is likely to be seeking perfection. In other words, paying too much attention to detail. If you continually revise a document before handing it in, or spend more time giving feedback on someone else's work than they spent writing it, you are being self-defeating. You are allowing your strength, attention to detail, to reduce your efficiency. You've heard the phrase, generous to a fault, to describe someone who is overly generous to the point of harming his or her own self-interest. We see the same in people who have an overdeveloped tendency to help others and try to provide unsolicited help and advice to the frustration of the recipient. Parents are notably guilty of this one. Ask any teenager. It's not hard to figure out our greatest weaknesses. Think of the feedback you've received in performance appraisals, including all those things with which you didn't agree. Look at the arguments you've had in close relationships. What did the other person accuse you of always doing? Regardless of the merit of their complaint, there's likely some truth there. And, of course, you can go back to your list of strengths and simply exaggerate them to find your weaknesses. Exercise. Write down your greatest weaknesses. See if you can find 3 to 5 traits or behaviors that regularly land you in trouble. Look for patterns in your behavior. There are always one-off circumstances that contribute to something not working out. But if the same thing keeps happening over and over, you become the constant in the equation, and you need to look at your own behavior to see what can be changed. I had an executive coaching client with a demanding job who complained that she worked endless hours cleaning up other people's work. Her team and other colleagues kept handing in subpar work that she would initially send back to be revised, but eventually fix herself because that was faster. Guess what? They kept submitting subpar work until she realized that she needed to change her behavior or nothing was going to change. A propensity to please can also land you in trouble. If you tend to overcommit and agree with the requests that others make of you, you'll find yourself constantly running and never feeling like you're doing the things that really matter to you. Laura was a successful writer and journalist who had an alarmingly strong tendency to please. Nothing gave her greater pleasure than other people's gratitude and admiration for her ability to manage tough assignments. No matter the deadline or difficulty of the writing assignment, she could spin gold from straw and deliver a credible article in an amazingly short period of time. She was regularly asked to turn turgid NGO jargon into compelling case studies that would inspire donors to fund worthwhile projects in developing countries. She managed all this from her dining room home office in Seattle. However, Laura realized that the more she delivered and the more difficult the assignment, The less it was regarded as something extraordinary, and the more she found herself working late or slammed against unreasonable deadlines that left her stressed and anxious. When she stepped back and realized her strength as a crack reporter, and her desire to please her editors was now working against her, she was able to push back and start dictating the terms of how she would work. How are your strengths working against you? What bad habits stand in your way of living the life you want? Michelangelo. Michelangelo was one of the most important artists of the High Renaissance. An artist, sculptor, architect, and poet, he's had a lasting impact on artists to this day. Hundreds of tourists flock to Italy every year to marvel at his painting in the Sistine Chapel, his Pietà, depicting Madonna and Christ, and his statue of David. He is less recognized for his philosophy, but his thinking around the creative process contains useful lessons for all of us. If people knew how hard I had to work to gain my mastery, it would not seem so wonderful at all. Michelangelo. Michelangelo recognized the importance of hard work, discipline, and effort in honing his craft and creating his masterpieces. He was of the school of practice makes perfect, not the school of wait for the muse to strike. This applies to us in the workplace and our lives, as we try to create the life we want to be living, rather than the frazzled, unsatisfying one we've got. The fastest way to do this is to build upon your strengths. You are not a remedial case. You've had success and done well. This is about building on success and paring away the rest. Dean Robinson was the head of an accounting firm in Australia that specialized in privately held family businesses. He was excellent at what he did, and his clients loved him, but he wasn't happy. He had a team of 15 people, including a partner in the firm with much less experience than him. Dean was the rainmaker, the dealmaker, and the person responsible for quality control. He was unhappy because he was working all hours, constantly fighting fires on the personnel front and leading a rearguard action to maintain the quality he wanted for his clients. Although the firm had revenues of $2 million annually, he was only taking home a small portion. He began to resent his employees, who were much less committed to the firm than he was and seemed to have a sense of entitlement around pay and benefits that didn't align with their contribution or quality of work. What Dean really loved about his job was advising clients on their businesses and long-term goals, not the minutiae of their tax returns. He was helping family-owned businesses professionalize, aggressively grow their businesses, and think about the future with succession planning. His clients loved his strategic perspective and the tremendous value it created for their businesses. But Dean was still caught up in the day-to-day dealings of tax returns and audits, not able to offer his strategic services to every client that wanted them. Finally, he decided he had had enough. It had become very clear that Dean's greatest strength was his ability to develop a strategic vision for his clients' businesses and show them how that supported and developed the owner's family life. Yes, he could offer excellent accounting and tax service, but so could others. However, very few people could help family-owned businesses reach their full potential. And that was also what he loved to do. The greater danger for most of us lies not in setting our aim too high and falling short, but in setting our aim too low and achieving our mark. Michelangelo. So Dean dissolved the partnership, sold the existing practice to his partner, and set out on his own. It took courage, belief in himself, and a lot of discipline and effort to start over, almost from scratch. He was now focused only on what he was best at and discarded the rest. Dean says the greatest challenges were operational and personal. It was hard on the people around him, including his wife, who also worked in the business. I was having the professional equivalent of a midlife crisis, except for me it wasn't a crisis at all. It was the morphing of a caterpillar into the butterfly. Dean told me, some days were awful. I was getting frustrated. I was becoming short-tempered, but I continued to question. I didn't stop and accept what was happening. I did what I had to do to get the task finished and figure out what I could learn and how to do it faster. I'm on the right path and know this is what I want to be doing with my life. I saw the angel in the marble and carved until I set him free. Michelangelo. There were moments of frustration and anxiety as Dean began to build his new business, but there were no moments of doubt. He knew his strengths and the direction in which he needed to go. You can do the same. Every block of stone has a statue inside it, and it is the task of the sculptor to discover it. Michelangelo. Down to the essentials. In order to create a meaningful life, you need to stop doing some of the things you've been doing up until now, not just building new habits. You have to identify the habits, relationships, and beliefs that are holding you back. Then you need to ditch them. Like Michelangelo, you need to pare back what is extraneous to your goal, the life you want. Only then can you live your life in a satisfying, rewarding way. Easier said than done, right? Take a look right now at where your time is spent. Exercise. Keep a journal to track where your time is going. Don't try to account for every task. Rather, note what you are doing in 15, 30, or 60-minute intervals, whichever you find easier. Jot down in a short note form that will be recognizable to you. There is no need to write out a lot of detail. Do this for 1 week and see where your time is going. At work, do the same. Keep it simple. I did this exercise shortly after setting up my consulting business. I thought I was working pretty hard and that I was focused on what I needed to do to win clients. I had been reaching out to people I knew to see if they needed help or could recommend me to others. The exercise was very revealing. I was spending huge amounts of time and money having coffee and lunches with former colleagues and friends. Yes, some of them had the ability to hire me, but most did not. And many of them had the ability to recommend me, but not all. And I was spending up to 3 hours finding that out. For example, we would arrange to meet for lunch, which, including travel time from home, could take 3 hours out of my day. A simple 30-minute phone call from my home office was just as productive, especially with people who already knew me well. It took a lot of discipline to turn down suggestions to meet in person from people whom I knew and liked, and instead suggest we have a quick call. However, the phone calls quickly clarified if I could help them or if they knew people who needed my help. Then I would set up meetings in person that were much more productive. The exercise of tracking where your time goes might seem like a chore in itself, but much like keeping a food diary can reveal the fallacies of what you think you eat versus what you actually eat, this is a powerful tool to see where your day really goes. Once you've done the exercise, you should see some obvious opportunities to make changes. The secret is then to schedule the things you really want to do, like going to the gym on your lunch break. Start by making it an appointment in your calendar that needs to be moved before it can be overridden. Now look at things that could be done by someone else. We will come back to outsourcing and building a supportive infrastructure later in the book. But right now, look at the amount of time spent on things that can be done by someone else. Take your time tracker and quickly highlight all of the tasks at home or work that can be delegated. For example, anyone can walk your dog, but only you can meditate. Anyone can fold laundry, but only you can take your shower or get your hair cut. Anyone can take notes at a meeting or set up the next meeting, but only you can attend parents' night at your child's school. Start looking for opportunities to take things on your plate or in your inbox and move them out, permanently. I was once responsible for 30 direct reports, a ridiculous structure from an organizational point of view. Regardless, twice a year at performance review time, I was responsible for writing 30 performance assessments, a task of many hours. Instead, I had a performance conversation with each person, which was also required, and asked them at the end of it to write up their understanding of the conversation, their areas of development, and so on, and email it to me. I would simply add that email to their performance file. If I didn't agree or felt they missed something, I replied with those comments and put that email in the system. Suddenly, an entire week had been cleared of tedious summations of assessments. Take a look at how your time is being spent, and see how you can pare away the extraneous in order to focus on the essentials, the things that help you, and the things you most enjoy. Chapter 2. Destination, not daydream. In a nutshell, clarify your ideal state. If you don't have a clear destination in mind, it's going to be hard to get there. Don't limit yourself by what you think is possible. In an ideal world, what would you be doing? Defining the ideal future and comparing it to the present brings into reality what needs to be changed and ignites the engine for forward motion. On October 2016, I was speaking at a conference of corporate treasury professionals in Orlando. These individuals are the unsung heroes of the financial world, the people dedicated to the long-term financial health and sustainability of their companies. The businesses in which they work include all sectors of the economy, but they rarely make the headlines. They are long-term planners and think in 3 to 5 year funding cycles, and often much longer. Yet when it came to planning their own careers, the topic on which I was speaking, they admitted they were much less diligent. It's hard to achieve your goals if you don't have any. That seems so obvious, yet the vast majority of the 500 people in the audience that day acknowledged they didn't have concrete goals for themselves, despite a desire to realize change and progress in their lives. You need to start by clarifying your ideal state. If you don't have a clear destination in mind, it's going to be hard to get there. Sketch the scene. Joe Peart, a native of counties Dublin and Kildare in Ireland, had studied international marketing at college. It was a competitive course, and many who applied were disappointed when they didn't receive a place in the program. The job prospects for graduates were considered good. After a year of studying in France as part of her degree, Jo was now also fluent in French. She began a career helping international companies expand into new markets, something she really enjoyed. But around age 40, after a number of successful years in corporate life, she began thinking about the future and what kind of contribution she would be making with her life. She decided that she really wanted to be in medicine and wanted to retrain as a doctor. "I did it because I had always remained interested in medicine, in particular the provision of health services and health policy. I hate talking about things rather than taking action, and I know from corporate life that the most effective cultural change is from within," Jo told me. She was surprised by the almost unanimous support from her friends and family and by the number of friends that had also considered going back and doing the same. It was those in medicine who questioned her decision to leave corporate life, where she was already earning substantially more than many of her peers, in order to be a student once more at the beginning of a daunting training program. Jo didn't see it that way at all. "I did it because I could. I hadn't been pining. I enjoyed work always, and as I had been lucky enough to grow in confidence, I was in a position to become somewhat successful and chose to follow a passion and a vision rather than a long-lost dream," she said. She began medical school, and after completing residencies and internships, 7 years after making the decision to retrain, she began working as a doctor. She now practices internal medicine at Connolly Hospital. She has never regretted the decision or regretted starting on a different path earlier. "I was extremely fortunate to do the degree I did because of the friends it gave me and the career choice I made. I don't regret it at all. For a young person making a choice out of school, medicine is a very confining career. I'm glad I came to it after my other experiences," she said. Jo's is an unusual case, but many of us spend years doing things we don't really enjoy because we think it would be impossible to change. We worry we won't make as much money or we'll lose the security of our present situation. We think we might fail and, really, where we are is not so bad. We rarely think we might be better off. We might be happier and actually earn more. We forget about the fact that change will come to our current situations. It won't remain static. Changes we can't foresee will make our current life less satisfying, and we become like the frog in increasingly warm water that doesn't notice the temperature is getting hotter until it's too late. One way to avoid this is to write down your ideal future state. How would you like things to be in an ideal world? Assume no constraints for the moment. What would you ideally like to be doing? How would you be spending your time? Most importantly, write it as though it was already real. Write it as though you are already in the future and you are describing your life. Exercise. Start at the top of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?